lot of seminars over the years where I've come away wondering, now, did I hear anything or learn anything that I didn't really know before? But I think if you just reflect back on what we've heard so far in this panel, I doubt if there's anybody here who's feeling that they haven't picked up new information that they really hadn't had drawn to their attention before. Our responder, although with latitude to go beyond that, is Patrick Fagan, and he comes from Edmund Burke's hometown of Dublin, Ireland, where he grew up and studied psychology and sociology through his master's degree. He worked in Canada before coming to the United States to do more graduate studies. He's married, and it's kind of an interesting thing in his bio here. He says he has a large family. He didn't commit himself. How many children do you have there?
Eight,
okay. That's something to be proud of there, Pat. He's been a very varied background, although all centering on a similar subject that's very pertinent today. Patrick has been a grade school teacher, a psychologist who specialized in children, family, and marriage. He has been a consultant to community welfare organizations and taught welfare social workers and trained Canadian family physicians in the dynamics of family, neighborhood, and community. In 1984, his work on community and family issues brought him into public policy issues, and he's been working in that area since. He's worked for the Free Congress Foundation, Senator Dan Coats, and then the Bush administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Family and Community Policy at Health and Human Services. He's presently Senior Policy Analyst for Family and Culture at a little-known foundation called the Heritage Foundation. And some of his more recent works are the Heritage Backgrounder called The Real Root Causes of Violent Crime, The Breakdown of Marriage, Family, and Community, and another one called Rising Illegitimacy, America's Social Catastrophe. Patrick, we're very much looking forward to hearing from you.
The past two papers have been very interesting, and I want to take from one of the underlying assumptions that's there in both those papers, which is that sense of community, the sense of belonging that, for instance, if you take in the fraternal organizations, that is right at their core, and the assumptions around which the existence, for instance, of a fraternal lodge and then the organization as a whole is all organized around that sense of solidarity, that sense of community, that the assumption of belonging. And I think the future scholarship for conservatives along this dimension, actually it beckons. It's a challenge that's there. It's, I think, very exciting times for social scientists. The marriage of the crisis of the day, which when you look back over history is one of the great advantages of crises, they beckon to be served. And on the intellectual level here, I think the crisis I see is the connection between freedom and belonging. And there is, I think, also here the chance for conservatives over the next decade to become the champions of the future and the champions of the child. The left has in the past sort of had that field for itself. It is failing our children massively, and the future generation needs a new champion. And I think all of the issues that we're concerned about will lead us to pay more and more attention to that, and for those who are concerned, hopefully to find solutions and good direction from us. As I pointed out at the Resource Bank, and for those of you who have been there, I don't spend too much time dwelling on it, but one of the most, the things that concerns me most is the breakdown of the family in this country, which is happening at a very rapid pace. Go over the statistics fairly quickly. We're at almost one-third in the 2 years ago, the latest figures we have, almost one-third, one out of every three children born out of wedlock, We expect it to be about 40% by the year 2000, and it will hit 50%, one out of every two children, by the year 2012-2015. At that stage, we are beyond crisis. We are beginning meltdown. And I think it has massive ramifications on the health level, on education level, on the economic level. Our capacity to produce will be diminished. The draw on the tax base will be much higher, or the draw on the rest of the community to make up for the weaknesses. I am not convinced, and would like to draw strong attention. I'm not convinced that the conservative critique of welfare is adequate, because it does not address, in manners and in tone and in rhetoric, a fundamental need that is there, which is the need to belong. I agree with all the general direction in my writings and lectures and defenses of welfare reform, of the contract with America. I have no disagreement with any of the policies, but I have a concern that they fall short and that they will not win with America, not just because of the buy-in of groups, of all of us, to the entitlements of one form or another, but because of another spirit which I think is deep in America, which is essentially there's a spirit of generosity about the country. You look at our international aid and all the rest, and the concern that the needy not be massively neglected. And I do think that in the conservative rhetoric, we have not delivered a tone that we are concerned for the poor. We are concerned for the economy. And even as we must cut off false supports or supports, economic supports, which reinforce bad things, we must also deliver a message which essentially pulls the poor and the needy towards us, not push them away. If the only thing we are going to do is to push them away by cutting off the disincentives, I, for one, don't want to be part of it. And I suspect most of us don't either. But we must address, and this, I think, is the challenge to conservatives, how do we combine both of those elements of cutting off the disincentives on the economic level while studying and finding the incentives to belong, to become part of the community, to be adult, to be responsible, to be capable and compassionate adults. That is the challenge that is there for us. The left will not rise to it. They cannot. So the field is ours if we will go to it. Let me propose a couple of dimensions along which this can be done. The newborn child is a mass of potential. Different children with different potential, different talents. Some have two, some have one, some have five, some have ten. But our work as citizens and as members of our community is to draw out of every child the greatest potential that we can, both what he can give and what through our drawing out of him, what we are capable of drawing out. How is that done? The first is an old phrase. The Christian phrase is love. Modern psychological term is unacceptable or unconditional acceptance. Not unacceptable conditions. But the love, the acceptance. And this, I think, has to come before expectations of behavior. I am concerned also that if we concentrate on the moral criteria, which it is appropriate to demand, but if we concentrate and emphasize that before we have emphasized acceptance, we are essentially rejecting the person. And we are rejecting the poor, and we are rejecting the needy, we are rejecting our adults, we are rejecting those who are yet incapable of being sufficiently independent, and they will walk away. And given the levels of fracturing which is already there, there is a danger, actually, of a backlash. And I think we do have to give our poor hope and leadership that we can point to a way of their participating again as fuller members of the community and find ways towards essentially membership in the community. And all of the economic issues, I think, that have been discussed are all a very, very significant part of it. But the belonging first. Fundamental to that, actually, I think, is the marriage of the father and mother. My own work and clinical work, and I think every family therapist, all therapists, people in this field, know how damaging conflict within the family is. And how every adult, it's almost an axiom among family therapists that if you don't work out the difficulty in the first marriage, you'll begin to realize that you have to work it out by the third or fourth, and it'll be the same difficulty. That we bring that baggage with us. And those of us who have been married more than once know that. The difficult work of the agreement to love. There is a right, I think, that we ought to start talking about, the right of every child to the dedicated love of his parents, his biological father and mother, that he not be split at birth, to their dedication to each other and to the child over at least his years of growing up, to about his 18th year at minimum. It'll damage him also if his parents divorce after that, but it will be less. And these are not easy things to say, they're not easy things to consider, because we've all either hurt or been hurt, or those close to us are hurt by these things. But they hurt our children even more. And they are part of the cultural drift, which demographers sum up by being what we call a red shift. And one of the phenomena of American culture today, and has been for some time, is that as a people, one of our characteristics is that we grow further apart, not more together. Our divorce rates are going up, our out-of-wedlock birth rates are going up, even on the material level, we live further and further apart from there, that's where we grew up. Not always is there a moral element involved in here, but it is an overall characteristic of our culture. And in somehow, we have to find the ways to grapple with that and learn deliberately how to recreate and foster community, foster belongingness, foster being more together. Because it's only in those conditions that the child can reach his or her potential. And in a way, actually, as John Bundell was going down through the things which we most need, a number of things struck me where there's a real parallel here. In welfare reform, our greatest need actually is talent. The liberal, mainly materially based view of poverty stemming from a lack of income has in some ways, I think, distorted or blinded us to another big side of welfare reform, which is over and above the economic, is the social. That the talent we need is the talent of giving persons. You're probably, a number of you may be familiar with the work that Bob Woodson does with the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, where he has spent his lifetime essentially identifying groups which are making a real difference to the very poor right within their communities and are drawing these talents out of people and helping them reach their potential and their independence. The biggest thing which is needed there is not the material resources, though they're needed, but is actually the human talent, the dedicated people who will give their time to others. And the biggest giving actually is, and the most difficult to do, is the giving of time, and the giving of time in dialogue. The giving of time to a needy person to talk, to listen, and to draw the person out. If we don't do that, if there is no dialogue, essentially, welfare reform will fail. And by dialogue, I mean very simple, ordinary conversation. For those needy people, and we're having more and more of them because of the social conditions we have put in place, The demand is for a massive infusion of time spent talking. The medium of talk is critical. It is through talk and dialogue that a baby, and every one of us who are parents can see this, your children blossom if you spend time talking with them. Cut off the talk through any pressure of work, etc., they will wilt. The same is true of your marriage. The same is true of family life as a whole. That is what makes a neighborhood, is talk. Very simple, it's talk, it's the giving and the listening. And that aspect actually is driven out. Another whole area for our consideration is the way our material culture is being shaped, is driving this out. Just think of television. If we had perfect content on it, it still would be disastrous at the levels at which we are doing it, because it drives out conversation between husbands and wives, parents and children, family and neighborhoods. Somebody told me a brilliant little anecdote that if H.G. Wells had written a horror story about the future where you walk down through a neighborhood and nobody is talking at night, there is nobody out, and you look in through the windows and you see a blue glow and a lot of people standing around or sitting around just looking at a blue glow and a piece of furniture in the corner and nobody's talking. That would have been a horror story if written 100 years ago. It is reality today. So there's a lot here on the social dimension that demands of us conservatives to address. I don't have the solutions, but you can definitely, I hope I'm conveying some of the sense of the challenge that is there in front of us, so that as we address those, we can see a great potential in the person, and the poor and the needy and the dispossessed receive from us a sense that we are concerned that they belong, not just that they be capable economic participants in the economy, but that they be full members of the community, that America be what it was meant to be, where the Statue of Liberty is that which beckons and pulls us into a community that wants its poor and its needy. And I think there's a whole realm of research and writing to be done there that only conservatives, I think, have the capacity to address, because we do understand the critical nature of freedom. I contend that freedom to be is not possible without belonging. Thank you.
I think we ought to tell Patrick that we've solved this problem of time in this country. We've come up with a concept of quality time, where 15 minutes will do the whole trick. But,